Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Thoughts in time and out of season. The hitchhiker stood by the side of the road and leveled his thumb in the calm calculus of reason.
My mother told me never to do this. Bless you. My name's Jim Halsey.
John Ryder.
So you want me to drop you off somewhere?
I'm getting your car wet.
Oh, this isn't my car. It's a drive-away. The guy who owns it's in San Diego. So where are you headed?
You got a smoke?
Yeah, sure. You gonna tell me where you're going?
Yeah, sure.
Looking at me like that for?
Just looking.
What about gas?
I don't need gas.
What do you want? What's so funny?
That's where the other guy's at.
Who's the other guy?
The guy who was driving that car back there. The guy who picked me up before you did.
Was that him in the car?
Yeah, sure it was. Didn't walk very far.
Why is that?
Because I cut off his legs and his arms and his head. And I'm gonna do the same to you. You wanna know what happens to an eyeball when it gets punctured? Do you got any idea how much blood jets out of a guy's neck when his throat's gonna slip?
What do you want?
I want you to stop me.
You got the knife. You'll stick me with it before I can do anything.
That's right. So what have you got to lose? Stop me.
Anything.
Say four words.
Okay.
Say one more.
Say what?
Say.
I don't know if I can say that.
Sure you can. Repeat after me.
I
want want?
What?
To.
To.
Welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Rob St. Mary is on a shoe shopping splurge in the Philippines. Joining me instead this week is BTS junkie Brian Kelly.
Hello.
And VHS truthsayer Josh Johnson.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you back, sir. It's been a little while. This week we're looking at the 1986 thriller, The Hitcher. The film stars C. Thomas Howell as Jim Halsey, a young man driving a ride-away car across the desert. Fighting back sleep, he picks up a sodden hitchhiker for company, John Ryder, played by Rutger Hauer. The film becomes a game of cat and mouse and murder as the psychotic Ryder tortures Jim and kills almost everyone Jim encounters. Josh, the last time you were with us on the show, we were talking Electric Light and Blue. We're back to the desert with this one. Tell me where you first saw this one and what stayed with you over the years.
Well, I don't remember specifically when I first saw it, but I do remember what the impact of it was, where as soon as the credits started rolling, I had the reaction that I've only had, you know, a few times in my life, where I immediately recognized that in my mind, this was a perfect movie, that there was nothing in it that I would change, that it's, you know, really held me in its grip from the opening frames to the very last. And that's a rare thing that is always exciting when it happens. And, you know, I guess the things that stuck with me were the cinematography, the pitch perfect performances across the board, obviously Rutger Hauer being the most impressive. And then also just the editing of it. Like, even though I was younger when I saw the movie, I remember really being taken with the pacing and the editing. And it kind of gave me, I think, a better understanding maybe than I had had before of how important it is to set the pace and structure your editing in a way that holds the audience in suspense.
Yeah, like Josh, I don't remember exactly when the first time was. It was probably when my parents were subjecting me to horror films at far too young an age. But I do remember years later in high school trying to recall a movie that had a very disturbing French fry scene and figuring out what that was, rewatching it and recalling specific scenes in it. That was kind of, I agree with Josh, it's kind of, you kind of have a moment at the end of The Hitcher where you realize just everything comes together in such a spectacular way that you really can't imagine anything being different. And as a man who likes to keep a lot of lists in his head, I keep two things out of this movie forever in my head on lists. And one, it has my second favorite gas station explosion scene. And it has actually my favorite car rolling scene.
I have to ask, what is your favorite gas station exploding scene?
Thunder Warrior. Pretty insane because it's like a domino effect of explosions in that movie.
I don't know if you had a chance to read the script that I posted, but oh my goodness, the original script by Eric Red, totally tight. And I think it is kind of really the star of the film. There's not a whole lot that changed from script to screen, which is kind of crazy because Red really comes up with these really elaborate set pieces. I mean, the whole desert storm kind of thing. And I'm not talking about an invasion, you know, moniker or anything. I'm talking about a literal sandstorm out in the desert where we see Ryder one of the times. I mean, he's kind of associated with a lot of the elements. I mean, the first time we see him, it's in the rain. Another time we see him, it's when he's, you know, out in this really thick sandstorm, you know, and then of course he's flying through the air and setting gas stations on fire. He's very much a creature of the elements. The only thing that I can really think of that changed from the script to the screen, there were maybe three things. One was the way that Ryder looks in the script. He's really thin, and apparently Red kind of based the character on Keith Richards. I can almost see a Keith Richards character out there, you know, terrorizing people. Just looking at Keith Richards is sometimes terrorizing enough. The other thing was that Halsey and Nash, who's played by Jennifer Jason Leigh in the film, she kind of becomes,
I won't say the love interest, which I kind of appreciate that she's not really the love interest, but she's just this kind of woman that's swept up in this whole thing. They end up having sex at one point. They don't in the movie, which I think actually works better than the sex scene in the script. It kind of rings a little bit false. And the third thing, and this one is very minor, but it stuck out for me majorly, was that the character of Sheriff Estridge in the film, his name is Estridge. In the script, it was Esterhaus, which I was wondering if that was like a Eric Red nod to Joe Esterhaus. But we'll never know because Mr. Red wouldn't come on the show with us. So, but anyway, did you guys get a chance to look at the short that Robert Harmon had done before The Hitcher, which is called China Lake?
I watched it many years ago when I reviewed the UK DVD. The movie's treated very poorly for the US DVD. The UK DVD is quite a great investment.
Yeah, and it's great that that is on there because it really was kind of a good precursor to The Hitcher. And it was really great for me because it stars Charles Napier, who I really, I always loved seeing him and stuff. It was interesting because in that one, rather than it being a psycho killer that's kind of terrorizing people, it's a cop out there terrorizing people, kind of like on his vacation. It's like going out to the desert and really, you know, kind of effing with people out on the road and abusing his power, which it kind of plays into The Hitcher, where you've got cops who just kind of don't understand. And they're kind of these, like, you know, mindless drone kind of things. And they're just being used as pawns in the game that Ryder is playing with Halsey.
When you talk, if you listen to the scene-specific commentaries on the UK DVD, John Seale talks about how they were very cognizant of not making it too Western-inspired, but there are nods to the Western through the film, and I think they do come directly from Red Script and those cop characters, where everything's black and white to them, and they have their man when they have Halsey, and nothing's going to stop them from bringing him to justice, even when there's this other thing, other external force that to any logical human being is doing things to stop their pursuit. And that's a very Western concept, the sheriff on his horse, in this case, obviously, police cars in the desert, you know, bringing their man to justice at all costs.
And you also have, I think, with the naming of the characters, some nods to the Western. I mean, Halsey and Ryder, to me, are absolutely names of characters in Westerns. You know, I think one of the things that's really appealing and that makes the film really accessible is that a lot of that stuff is really overt, even if you're, you know, fairly young, or maybe if you don't tend to really analyze films on a really deep level. All of those things come across and can be processed by the average audience member. So even somebody who maybe wasn't looking for that is probably going to take something away, even if they didn't go in looking for it.
There is that kind of broad stuff, but then there's a lot of very subtle things that they're doing, a lot of camera moves that unless you're kind of paying attention, you don't really realize just how effective they are. I mean, I should have said this earlier. This was the first feature film that Eric Red wrote and the first feature film that Robert Harmon directed. So the two things together, they were kind of not knowing what they could do, and they just kind of went balls out with all of it for me. I mean, just the way that Red would write these scenes, you know, that probably, you know, later on would be completely toned down and, you know, well, we can't do that for budgetary reasons or we can't do that for logistical reasons. They did it, you know, and some of these camera moves that Harmon was doing, you know, via his DP, hey, you know, let's set up a track and roll this camera along where it's right on the ground and look up at the end, you know, tilt up at the end into Ryder's face and, you know, just great stylistic stuff that you wouldn't normally see folks doing, but they were doing it because they didn't have the experience and didn't have people kind of beating them down and telling them that they couldn't do this kind of stuff. So I thought that it was really nice. And the other thing, we were talking about kind of broad strokes with the characters' names and stuff, but there was so much nice implied things going on here. And I'm thinking specifically about the Nash character and, spoiler alert, the way that she meets her demise. I love that moment of implied violence where your mind creates so much more havoc than what is actually shown on the screen.
And the way that that entire scene is paced and built up with the sound of the truck idling and Ryder revving it and Halsey having every opportunity to stop him the tension doesn't need any sort of visual release. It just needs a scene transition into something else where you know that he has failed to stop Ryder, or chosen not to stop Ryder, actually, the way it plays out in that scene. Any sort of visual cue could never have any sort of impact as just knowing what happened to her does.
You know, this is probably one of the few films that I've ever seen where the main character really contemplates killing himself. I mean, there are so many movies, you know, I'm a big fan of film noir, and in film noir, you know, one of the famous definitions of film noir is at the beginning of the movie, you're fucked, and at the end of the movie, you're even more fucked than at the beginning. And in this movie, you know, he's really just getting fucked over and over and over through this whole thing. And this is one of the few times where I've seen a character take a gun and put it in his mouth or up to his temple. I can't remember which it is at this moment, but just really contemplate, I'm going to off myself. You can put so many characters through so many ringers and you never see them take that step. And he is so close to doing that. He's closer to doing that than I think he is to killing John Ryder at that moment in the film we were just talking about.
It's really a testament to how well written these characters are, despite the broad strokes, that you actually accept and believe that he could be suicidal and could make that decision. Anytime you're presented with that in films where somebody is suicidal, it tends to involve a lot of shortcuts, or maybe you don't feel that it's earned, or you don't necessarily believe that it's going to happen. You recognize that you're being manipulated and that they're just trying to create this tension of whether or not the person will pull the trigger, when as an audience member, you really know they won't. But in the case of The Hitcher, it absolutely seems plausible that he really might do it.
What is your guys' take on why Ryder is torturing Halsey? What do you guys feel? Because I know that that's kind of the eternal question, and everybody can have their own interpretation of that.
I actually really like the way Harmon puts it, because it's a way I was never able to express it myself. And what Robert Harmon says is, if Jim Halsey had not gone down the road he had gone down, Ryder would not have been there. He would have been down the road that Halsey did go down. Ryder's an instrument for showing this young man all of human experience condensed into a couple of days. Getting back to some of the script changes, it's interesting you say that, you know, at one point they were supposed to have sex. And not getting too overly analytical, I think to have him have sex in the middle of that movie and have the cathartic release of orgasm wouldn't have worked thematically, because that can't come until he actually mans up and destroys Ryder. There's a second change that Eric Red talks about, where in the scene where Halsey approaches Ryder in the interrogation room, he was supposed to hand him a lockpick, slip him a lockpick without anybody seeing, which leads to the final confrontation. And the biggest argument on set was that one change, where Robert Harmon did not want to show that happening. He wanted them to have more of a psychic connection. And that makes more sense to the overall instrument that Ryder is, that he is that psychic link with Halsey. I think it would be too weird to say that Ryder doesn't exist, but he had to exist in that place for Halsey. For what reason? Ultimately, it doesn't really matter. It just matters that he's taken Halsey on this journey. And despite what The Hitcher 2 would have you believe, Halsey's better for it.
That's all really interesting, well thought out. And I'm glad that I'm answering second, because honestly, I have always made the active choice to never ask that question. I have no idea why he's doing it. I honestly don't want to know. I like experiencing the film with Ryder as this force of nature that is introduced into everything, and we don't necessarily know why he's doing it. So I've really never thought that much about it. I actually like not knowing what is motivating this terrifying force of nature to unleash hell on Jim Halsey. I actually like that there is no clear explanation.
You know, there is that kind of idea of Ryder being kind of a, I don't know, yeah, he can't be a figment of Halsey's imagination, but it is interesting if you were to think of him being that, you know, kind of predating like a Tyler Durden by, you know, 20 years or something. Because there are times where things happen in the film that really kind of go beyond what Ryder, even if he was just some sort of crazed maniac, you know, very clever crazed maniac, there are times where things go beyond what he could do. And there are times where things just seem to come out of a psychic place. I'm thinking particularly of the massacre at the police station, where you know, it's a gunshot that kind of wakes up Halsey, and he goes out to discover everyone is dead. You know, you don't get that carnage, but you get the aftermath. And I just love the way, again, it's implied violence, but just, you know, implied insane violence. And you, in that one, you see the aftermath. You don't see what leads up to it.
In a very strange way, it builds a mythos with ever calling attention to that mythos. There's something to Ryder, and it's very obvious by the dreamlike quality of the film and scenes like you're talking about where things just don't quite add up, but he's obviously a physical real being because multiple people interact with him. He's something else, and I don't want to know what that is, but I do like thinking about the effects and his path crossing with Halsey, which I think is the balance between, you know, what we're all saying.
However you want to look at the film, you have to acknowledge that Ryder is a real entity, but there's clearly something metaphysical at work beyond what the story is telling us.
Ryder seems to be kind of a character who's kind of sprung up from this desert. You know, he seems to be, like I was saying before, very much a force of nature and kind of, you know, associated with the elements and everything. I could be reading a whole lot more into that, but that's what I like to do. And for me, you know, I mentioned when during the intro that, you know, the last time you and I talked, Josh, we were talking about really the desert as a character in Electric Light and Blue. And for me, it kind of even, it's more of a character in this film, and the way that it interacts and the way that Harmon shot this stuff really kind of brings the desert, you know, right into your living room if you're watching this on video. And so I was wondering what you guys thought about the way that the desert interacts with the characters and the characters interact with the desert.
The Electric Light and Blue comparison is sort of interesting. What is noteworthy in that movie is not so much the way the desert and the location interacts with the characters, but the way that it defines them. The Robert Blake character in Electroglide is this very tiny person in this gigantic locale of Monument Valley, and he's sort of adrift in that area. But the actual location itself doesn't have that much bearing on the actual plot development. But in the case of The Hitcher, it's actually a character in that it interacts with the characters. It drives the story and the plot to a certain degree. It's actually kind of a physical being that manifests itself and interacts with our players to, you know, get them to the next stage of the story. And to that end, it's definitely far more a character in the case of The Hitcher than it was in Electroglide.
So when you think about a desert, and the desert in specifically in the U.S., I feel like it's the last place where you can really get lost and feel completely isolated. Deserts have just a mythology and a feeling to themselves, and when you make it a character in a horror movie and the way that it's presented in The Hitcher, you have to see the desert as a place where somebody can hide, but also be caught out in the open as well. So for Ryder to come and go in these dark shadows in a completely open land is really testament to not only Robert Harmon and his background as a still photographer, but John Seale, who shot the movie, and the way he kind of drowns everything in this weird shadow. And a lot of the nuance of the cinematography I didn't really appreciate until I got a chance to see it in 35mm on a big screen, and you realize how incredibly cinematic The Hitcher is. Viewed at home, it's a great thriller, great horror movie, but watching it in a theater, they were very aware of how big they could make this desert feel and present it as a challenge to Halsey to escape shadows and hidden places in a wide open land.
Yeah, and I think also having Halsey trapped out in the open like that with nothing around, the desolate nature of the desert does a really good job of, you know, playing into what you were talking about earlier of it being like this sort of coming of age for this character. When you're stranded in the middle of nowhere, truly in the middle of nowhere, and there's nothing visible around you for miles, obviously, if anything's going to happen, it's going to come from you. You are 100% responsible to get yourself out of whatever the situation is. And so there's never any suspicion that somebody's going to come to his aid. When you see him abandoned in the desert like that, you know that it's up to Halsey to fend for himself. And that's a nice thing for his character, too.
Kind of playing out what you were talking about with Electroglide, you know, the Robert Blake character being so insignificant against this desert setting. for me, the way that they shot Rutger Hauer, a lot of times, he was larger than life. I mean, the way that shot that I was talking about earlier with the camera kind of tilting up and showing him and just being, you know, taking up so much of that frame. And I'm so jealous, by the way, that you got to see this in 35 millimeter. I could only hope to, you know, this was a staple for me on HBO for years and years. Then that's where I think a lot of folks thought was cable way back in the day. But seeing it in the theater must have just been a completely different experience for this. But, you know, I think that Hauer is as big as the desert, and he is, you know, a creature of this whole thing. And it's kind of interesting when we see him at the police station. He's so out of his element in that scene, and it's telling for me that that's the one time where it seems like Jim has the upper hand, but really, you know, he's still in control, even in that, you know, much more urban, even though it is out in the desert, but that urban setting of a police station. And the rest of the time, he's in his element. He is the elements when he's outside and taking care of business and really kind of, yeah, being all places and everything while Halsey is trying to get out there. And kind of one more thing before I forget, I think it's very telling too. You know, we've been kind of playing around with the idea of, is Ryder maybe a figment of Jim's imagination or not? I think it's very telling that the movie begins with him, with Halsey going through the desert and falling asleep at the wheel, you know, and that kind of sets up that idea that maybe he could be a creature of his dreams, but really much more a creature of his nightmares.
On that note, one of the films that I did think about quite a bit when I saw The Hitcher in 35 millimeter and the way that they frame Ryder and the way he seems to be almost in control of the elements, it reminded me a little bit of Richard Stanley's Dust Devil and the way the lead character in that is framed with some of those shots in the desert and circling around him, where he seems to be larger than the space itself and in control of the elements. I think in some ways there's some aesthetic similarities between those two films.
All right, so we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with interviews that we did with director Richard Harmon and star Rutger Hauer. I'm going to apologize about the sound quality of Rutger Hauer's interview right here. It sounded like he was next to, and I guess it's fitting in this instance, it sounded like he was right next to a highway. So every once in a while, things kind of get a little touch and go. I think he was actually in his trailer shooting another movie. So it is what it is. So I do want to set things up when we come back and we hear from Mr. Hauer. The first question that I asked him was to kind of give me a little bit of background and tell me some of the turning points of his career. So he really kind of starts to lay things out for us as far as where he came from and where The Hitcher fits into everything.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
I started out with a Dutch career. I made about 7 films in Holland. And Soldier of Orange was the first film. Turkish Delight was the film that launched me, and also a series that I did, a television series called Floris van Rosemont, which was a knighthood, sort of an Ivanhoe series. Mm-hmm. That launched me in Holland, and then I had Turkish Delight, which was my first film. That was quite a meaningful moment because I found my medium. And then Soldier of Orange, I found a chance to go to America. And I decided to find a lawyer and an agent there, and when I was promoting the film, because they had a release there. So that was key. That film was key for me. And then, the first thing I did was Nighthawks. And that wasn't a bad start. But it was an amazing, strong start for a part that was basically, it could have been anything, but people talked about it. So And then I, you know, did a film in Paris, and the second film was in Paris with an American producer, and it was about Coco Chanel. It was a simple little, you know, a little film, and it was all fun and no big deal. And then I got Blade Runner, and that, you know, Blade Runner basically has made me immortal. And it meant a lot for me because I had an incredible amount of fun making it, and I had a very good link with the director. And for that film to come out the way it did and then to last 30 years now, that's just, you know, it cannot get any better. So that's my, you know, my jewel in the crown. And then, you know, films like Lady Hawk and Blind Fury. And Blind Fury was sort of a comedy, which I hadn't done. But that was, to me, meant a lot, and I had a good time doing it. And then Lady Hawk was a moment because I had met with the director before that when they offered me the bad guy in the script, and I thought it was boring. And I said, you know, sorry, but it's to find another guy to do this. I don't think it's interesting. But if you want me to play the lead in this, then I'll be game. Okay, goodbye. and a year later, they called me because Kurt Russell had kind of falling out with Donner about how to do it. And they both felt they weren't able to fix it. And then he called me up. So I got that role. And that role was my first sort of leading role, rather than being, you know, being a bad guy or any other character. So that was another unusual step, because this doesn't happen a lot, I don't think, you know. And then the funny thing is that The Hitcher meant an incredible amount to me, because I made The Hitcher on instinct. I decided in like 3 days after meeting the director and reading the screenplay and seeing his short film, I thought, this is perfect. And this was just at the moment that Lady Hawk was released. And people were telling me I was going to play the good guys. And I didn't understand it, because I think, you know, I'm an actor. I'm not here to play any sort of guy. I'm here to sort of see if I can create a variety of characters in certain films and then see if it works. And learn from it. I just basically came to America to learn to be a better film actor, because there's no training in Europe. And from what I can see, there's very little training here also. So I did The Hitcher. And for that film to be a cult film for so long is just delicious, because I made it like I went, bullshit. This is a great script. It's a horror movie of the best kind in my mind. The director and I felt at home with each other from the first moment. And I thought, yeah, there's no way, you know, there's no way. I'm an actor. I'm going to do this.
You just kind of threw yourself into the role, it feels like.
Yeah, I felt very confident, because I felt that I could, the material sort of spoke to me, and so did the director. So what else do you need? You know, I don't think you need much more than that.
You did a ton of your own stunts in this one as well.
Yeah, I did a stunt. Part of the jumping out of the car was fun. And and a lot of the movies that I did until that movie, I did a lot of my own stunts. If I felt I could, and if the director would allow it. In The Hitcher, I did one, and then I lost a tooth because I hit myself with a gun while I was trying to be so cool. And then they had to fly me back to Santa Monica to put the tooth back in, or fix it or something. And that was kind of fun, because they let me fly the plane. So,
were they more open in Europe to you doing your own stunts than when you came here to the States?
No. Well, you know, you would think so, because the States, people can sue. And that wasn't so much the plan in Europe, but it really depended on the director, you know. Horse riding is not so safe, you know. I mean, horses, I've been on horses with two stunt people being blown up by an explosion that was too big. And they both broke their back. One broke his,
oh, wow,
broke his neck. And I got off the horse also. But I got lucky, you know, I don't know. So stunts are weird things, because things always go wrong a little bit. So it's really tricky to figure out what the risk is here, and what you actually, how much you, how far your own control is. I remember, you know, in A Call of the Wild, I literally almost drowned on the stunt. And every stunt guy, in, you know, that was standing there said, no, no, it's going to be okay. But the river was so wild. And I got stuck under a rock and the water was going over me. And I thought, this is the end of me. But, you know, stuff like that happens. It does happen. Action movies, that's where the charm is, but it's also where the danger is now and then. Movie making is not safe. This is not a safe, this is not safe at all. If you want a safe life, you have to choose another profession.
What is your way that you get into character, that you, you know, do you do a lot of research before you jump into a film, or what is the method for you?
Well, the method is, if I need to, I do feel a little reluctant to do too much work on the research because I want to draw from the things that are there rather than from things that are like somewhere else. I don't want to give too much to the audience. I want to give them just enough. And that's not being lazy. That's sort of my own pure approach to it. I'm pulling from, let's say, sort of a vague... I tend to think of what I do as broad strokes, pretty much. And I do think that an actor is a model for the character. He's not the character. He's a model for it. So the character needs to be open in many ways and have texture that you can still get in. That's the idea I sort of keep holding on to. I don't want to tell them everything. I want to tell them a little bit now and then they have to finish the film. I really think that the film that the audience likes is because they are half of the movie. You know, an audience completes the movie. It's not, it's the movie itself is nothing. So I talk to the director a lot. I read the script a ton of times. It's like I'm chewing it, you know, every day and get my ideas and then sort of line them up and make a recipe for the character and for where the moments are that I can reveal something that I think is interesting. And then these moments, you know, sometimes they appear, sometimes they do go past, and then I'll still keep it in mind because it's never too late. It's funny how that works, that some, you know, you always get another chance somewhere else. And if you don't, it's fine. It's not a disaster. But the key is to not give away too much and not get too serious. I know that sounds weird because I'm a dead serious actor, but at the same time, I'm treating it loosely.
The reason why I'm asking this, I guess, is just because John Ryder is such an enigmatic character. And so I was wondering, when you were being him, if you had ideas in your head as far as why he was doing the things he was doing. You had to have some more motivation than necessarily what we saw on the screen.
Yeah, no, well, I had some ideas, but they were never to be explored or said because that would make the film, that would be completely wrong. The charm of this character is that you don't know who he is. And you never really do, because John Ryder is a truck company. He does things that are like, that are almost like, how do you get out of your handcuffs when you're in a truck and then get the gun and jump out of it? It's just, there are certain things in that film that are impossible. And I felt that this is our challenge, and you make a character that has like a quality that you think he can do anything, this guy. So it wouldn't hurt when you see that, you know, he killed 3 cops or 5 in the dog and you never see it and you believe it. And this is not a character you should explain. Otherwise, he dies. He dies too soon.
But then they somehow brought him back for a sequel.
I guess they thought they could make some money. I don't know. Maybe he can do it better.
Oh, I doubt that. Because everybody was just so perfect in the film. I mean, C. Thomas Howell, you, Jennifer Jason Leigh. I was reading your autobiography, and you were talking about how Jennifer just came in and just got right into character, and how you two had had that, you had worked together before with Flesh and Blood.
Yeah, I didn't know she was going to do it. Yeah, it was a nice surprise.
And I also read you were saying that C. Thomas Howell was afraid of you all the time.
Yeah, he didn't tell me, so I didn't quite know, and I thought it was method acting. But when you shoot like 12 hours a day, you're not really actually, the real thing is that you're not going for dinner right away. You're going to go call some friends or do the things that you have to do. And that's your own life. So, but I know he was very excited when he shot that movie. It was the first big role for him. And I loved him for who he was because he was so gentle and so easy to play with. And he allowed me so... I could just kiss this guy and he wouldn't even budge, and go, why are you doing that? So he was like in my hand. I think that's what made the movie so horrifying, that this kid just doesn't, he's just frozen all the time.
What have been some of the stronger reactions that you've gotten to that film?
Well, most of the reactions, the guys would say, it's a great date movie. I would have to say, okay, well, really? How was that? And they would go, well, you have the girl here, and then it's scary, and they go, ah! Oh, boy. So that's nice. And then, and a lot of people say, it's so horrible, and it's so scary. Well, that was the plan, To me, the movie is a dance with the audience, really, where you try and catch them off guard. And I love it because that's like timing. Normally, you take the normal timing, and it's almost comedy timing, and you go one, two, three. and so you sort of redesign the tap dance with the way you play it, and the audience loved it. And the way they were standing on their chairs in Houston when we opened the movie the first night, and it was like a midnight screening, and when they were on their chairs, like literally all these kids, when the hitcher shoots the helicopter, I mean, you cannot shoot a helicopter. That's like a chance out of a million, and that's like, no problem. Okay.
You've said that you see a lot of humor in the film too, right?
Yeah, for me, there's a lot of humor. Yeah, it's like a very wicked Dennis the Menace humor, but it has to do with fucking people around too. I mean, I constantly felt that the film, that's what the film wanted to do, and that's what I was doing. And in my mind, I just felt the audience in a way. Let's say they were inside me while I was dancing, that's for sure.
I have such a hard time believing that this is your debut film, because it is just, it looks so good, and everything about it just, it snaps together, and just, it holds up too. I've rewatched it a few times over the last few weeks, and it is just, keeps me on the edge of my seat, even though I know what's going to happen.
That's great. Well, debut film on a professional level, I had made one short, other than, if you don't go back to elementary school, I was shooting films, but in terms of anything real, I made a short film to move myself from DP to director. I love shooting. I love photography, but it's not what I really wanted to do for a living. So I wanted to be a director. So I made a short. I wrote and directed and photographed a short. So that was, in effect, my debut, although it was all self-financed. It was really just designed to be a calling card for me, which it was, and it got me The Hitcher. It's a 30-minute film called China Lake.
Right, which is on the Europe DVD of The Hitcher. And, correct, man, it blew me away. It looks so good. I can't believe that this thing was a self-financed film. I mean, it looks terrific. And the caliber of actors that you got in it, between Charles Napier and William Sanderson, two of my favorite character actors.
Me too. No, I got really lucky, but... even at that time, I was, I guess, in my early 30s, I had been looking through lenses, being a photographer since I was eight or nine or 10 years old was when I started all that stuff. I just fell in love with it, and I've really never gotten over it. So it's a huge part of what I like to bring to filmmaking. And in the case of China Lake, I'm very happy that you like the way it looked. That's great. But I wasn't a director then. I was a cameraman, and I was spending every cent I had on that movie. And I knew it went for years, just being broke over putting everything into it. And I just said to myself, I better shoot this myself, because if this tall directing thing doesn't work, I don't want to spend all this money for nothing. It'll at least be able to function as a DP reel for me. But luckily, the directing thing did work, so I didn't have to go down that road. But that's really the only reason I shot it myself, because I didn't want I didn't want it to be a complete waste if it didn't work for me as a directorial calling card.
So how long did it take to actually make that film?
Sort of a joke, but it's true. Shot for 9 days, in post-production for 2 years. If I was lucky enough to have a career in this business, it would be the last time that time meant nothing. Everybody was doing it for free and as favors. So we have some pretty remarkable people who helped me with that movie. They're professionals, and they would say, sure, I'll help you, but I can only do it when I can do it. Like Bob Grieve. Robert Grieve was a fantastic sound editor, did pretty much every Larry Kasdan movie ever made and lots of other great stuff. And he agreed to help, but he kept getting work. So we just sort of shut down post-production sound for months at a time while he was off doing something. There were a lot of people that helped, but we had to wait for them. Cut in like 8 or 10 different cutting rooms. Very extreme stuff. We would actually sneak into professional working cutting rooms without the editor knowing. They'd go home. And I will not tell you who the editor is or what movies he was cutting, but they'd all go home. We'd go into the cutting room and cut all night and leave at dawn the next morning. And then he'd come back and cut the movie he was cutting and paying for the room. This was all on the old MGM lot, which is now, of course, Sony.
That was, what, 83? And then Hitcher was 86?
Yeah. China Lake was shot in 81, finished in 83. Hitcher was shot in 85, released in 86. But I was going to say, very nice to hear, very complimentary comments you made about the Hitcher. Very nice. But part of the reason is I had a long time to think about it. From the time they sent the script and the time he said, let's make this movie, I think at least a year went by of fooling around trying to get it made. Even though it had a home, it wasn't coming together for a really long time. But there was always a little bit of money flowing, so I would actually, you know, on their dime, I would actually go out with a production manager and we would scout around for locations and I'd make sketches and, you know, I haven't had that kind of sort of leisurely prep. In effect, it was prep for a year because I was able to think about it. We worked the script with Eric Red and on and on. It just went on and on and on. By the time I came to really shooting it, I really knew what I thought it should be. And I would say if it had come together quicker, if they'd said, all right, here's the script, let's go, and I've had a normal, you know, whatever it is, 8 or 10 week prep period, I don't think it would have been as good.
So what were some of the roadblocks that you're hitting while it was coming together?
You know, at that time, it was something called HBO Films, which is the organization that made it. HBO was making a series of features. And I don't want to get into a lot of detail, but the guy that ran that organization was a little difficult. And there were some casting issues, you know, people who wanted to do it, who they wouldn't hire, other people that I wanted to have do it. But it was on, it was off, it was on, it was off. And every time it was on, I'd make progress by scouting and finding locations and making drawings and thinking about scenes and on and on and on. So you're absolutely right about the casting. Having Rutger Hauer was beyond fantastic as a first film. And in fact, it was China Lake that did it because he was a little reluctant since I'd never done it before. But I screened China Lake for him and he signed up that afternoon. So that was good. That really worked.
And then it sounds like it was just some kind of serendipity that China Lake and Eric Red's script came across Feldman's desk all at the same time?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. When they sent the script over, I don't think it was an offer, but they sent the script and my agent said, read this. And I did. And I was probably less than halfway through it when I thought to myself, boy, did I make the right short for these guys? Because obviously the plot's different, but just in terms of tonality and feel and location, and it was almost like a 30-minute section of The Hitcher.
When you first got Red's script and you read through it, what were your initial impressions?
That there was definitely something there, but the script was somewhat different than the movie that we made. I mean, even Eric Red said when it was all over, when we finished the movie and it was successful and became this sort of cult thing. He said, you know, certainly not the movie I would have made, he said, but he seemed to like it. But the original script was far more violent, extremely violent, as I recall. Certain elements of Rutger Hauer's character's personality really weren't there. He was just more of my recollection is that he was much less interesting. He was much more just a sort of violent force, but he was almost inhuman in terms of his blankness. And also that Eric Red had always pictured Keith Richards. That's the other thing I remember.
Reading some of the things in the script, such as the dust storm when Ryder gets picked up, yeah. Reading that and then seeing you bring it to life, just exactly what was going on the page, but just that beautiful sandstorm. How did you guys create that?
Well, a lot of, you know, what are called Ritters, very large gasoline-powered propellers, basically. They make wind. That's what they're for. If you know what an E-fan is, it's like 100 times the size. I mean, the blades are like, I don't know what diameter, 8 or 10 feet in diameter. And you, line up three or four of those with a bunch of guys with masks on slinging, you know, at the time, it's all illegal now, but at the time, this material called Fuller's Earth, and slamming that in front of these things, and you get a windstorm. So there's some great stills of that day I still have. Of, we're just all covered, absolutely covered with this crap, which is now illegal because apparently it's bad to breathe in. Yeah, but of course, those were the days when if you wanted a windstorm, you had to physically do it in front of the lenses. There was no digital or anything, no CG of any sort in those days.
Now, this was Eric Red's first feature film as well. Did you see any kind of advantage, you guys both being kind of, I won't say novices to this, but definitely not being seasoned pros and coming in and just kind of having your own ideas?
Eric's thing is that he's, you know, he's a singular personality, and he can think of things that, I don't think he'd mind if I use the word, that a kind of normal person wouldn't think of, because you just don't go there. The killing of the Jennifer Jason Leigh character, for example, was, you know, that was an enormous issue with HBO films, and it was yelling about it and fighting about it, and I really credited Feldman with many, many things. But one of the things I really credited him with was fighting off of that, all of that. You know, you can't do that. You can't kill off the love interest, one of the main characters. And they kept saying, but that's the point. We want to make people think that can happen, anything can happen, that sort of stuff. You know, a seasoned screenwriter could easily have, without even realizing it, self-censored themselves and not written that, knowing that it would be nothing but trouble and would never happen. And so in that sense, I think it was probably helpful. And then, you know, I probably brought some of the same green, oh, sure, let's try to, we'll make this windstorm live. It'll be great. You know, it was a big pain in the neck, and a maybe more experienced director might have said, well, we hardly have any budget on this. We better, why don't we cut the windstorm? So what if it's not dusty and windy? You know, that kind of stuff. Yes. But what I did know was photography. I certainly knew that. And I learned a lot about acting from Rutger, I would say also.
How was your relationship with your cinematographer? Because he seemed to have a lot more experience coming in.
Oh, sure. John Field. I mean, he's the, you know, the legend John Field now, although he wasn't a legend then. It was his second American film. He'd just come off of Witness, which Ed Feldman had also produced. Hence, Ed said, you should talk to John Field. And I'd never met him, but he's in Australia. We couldn't afford to set up a meeting, so we had a couple of phone conversations, and it sounded like it was going to work fine. And it did. We made friends ever since. In fact, I just saw him at last year's ASC Awards. He got some kind of lifetime achievement. It was just fantastic to see him. No, that was very helpful to me to have somebody so experienced. Absolutely.
This seemed to be the first time where C. Thomas Howell was like, this is, you know, I'm going to break out of that teenage shell. How was it working with him?
Also fantastic. Yeah, I mean, I never had any sense. I don't recall ever thinking that that's what he should do. So he was determined to try to do a good job. And as he's always said, I don't know if you've talked to him, but he's always said that his Tommy Howell is not his character. His real fear of Rutger helped him. Rutger being so, you know, he tends, even if he doesn't try, he's a very big guy, and he's, you know, he can be intimidating just sitting there. And Tommy felt it, so, and used it in a very, very sort of positive way.
What was the casting like for Nash? What kind of person were you looking for?
Well, again, it's so long ago, I don't recall looking for a particular person, but I'll tell you a very short story, which won't answer your question, but it's worth knowing anyway. I don't recall, it was the first day of casting, but very early. And that was something that I was more nervous about that, I think, than directing the movie, because I'd never done that, except on China Lake, which was a very informal sort of thing. But the idea of having a lineup of actors and actresses coming in and sitting down and me having to tell them what I wanted them to do, it was very daunting. But I was happy that I was there, happy to make the movie. And it was on like the 38th floor of the Century City Towers here in L.A., where HBO used to be. Got into the elevator on the ground floor, and this woman walked into the elevator with me, very cute looking, with a little ponytail and a sort of little baseball cap on backwards, and holding a script, and the script said The Hitcher. So doors closed, we start to go up in the elevator, 30 or 40 floors. I said, oh, what? I see you must be coming to do a reading. She said, yes, I am. And I said, oh, well, I'm the director. At which point she turned to me, sort of eyed me up and down. I had very long hair and a big bushy beard. And she said, yeah, right. So I said, okay, and left it at that, knowing that what was going to happen. 25 minutes later, she's walked into the room and to read for that part. And of course, she apologized so profusely and went on and on and on. The only reason I'm telling you this is because an hour later, Jennifer Jason Leigh walked in and read the same scene and read the same part and was hired that afternoon. She so blew us away. There wasn't anybody else we ever wanted to see. We just stopped casting that part once she agreed to do it. So I don't even remember exactly what she did, but it was so clearly head and shoulders above what anybody else had done. And we were all excited about it, and it proved to be terrific. She's a unique talent, I think, too.
What I read in the script was she and C. Thomas Howell making love for the first time at the hotel, first and only. And I'm so glad that that wasn't in the film. I'm glad. I love the way that that scene was handled.
I don't remember, Ken. I don't even recall that that was in the script, but it was a kind of sense that we felt anyway, that with what was going on with them, it just was wrong. I don't know. Even looking back on it, I thought, oh, we don't want to do that. And everybody agreed, so we didn't. It was good. There's a certain intimacy, but it's not really, I was denied that she was any sort of love interest. It was really just a human interest. You know, you just needed to connect to somebody who wasn't completely crazy.
What was the shooting time on something like The Hitcher? I mean, I know you had plenty of time prepping for it, but when you actually called action to the final cut, what was it?
I would be guessing, and I have a number in my head, but I kind of can't believe it could be right. But maybe it was the day costs were cheap enough that I seem to remember something of like 50 days. It was really long to me, so it could very well be wrong. But there were a lot of stunts, and of course, when they were all done first unit, we didn't have a second unit. Pretty much every shot was our unit. So, you know, for example, the helicopter crashing, dropping out of the sky and all that stuff, I mean, that was an entire day just to do the helicopter. While first unit time was burning away, the helicopter pilot wanted to practice dropping things because he only had one shot of this. So we put a big X on the high, big chalk X on the highway where we wanted the helicopter to land. And for hours, he would fly overhead and drop a Volkswagen. We had an old Volkswagen that we used, and he just kept dropping it and dropping it to practice hitting the X until there was like nothing left but a tire and a fender, because every time he dropped it, pieces fell off.
What were the lessons that you learned with The Hitcher that you've gone on to use in other films?
The Hitcher being the first professional experience in which, quote, making your days and not going over budget or over schedule was, it was an everyday gigantic pressure. I found that, I think, one of the hardest things about directing a movie is, and it doesn't matter what the budget or schedule is, you can't do whatever you want. You can't do everything. You can't. And to be able to hold on to some sense of whatever your vision, and this sounds all kind of cliched and pretentious, but things don't become cliches for nothing. There's a lot of truth in it. Whatever your vision is, sometimes it's hard to know in what physical details that vision is hiding, if you follow me. I'm saying if you have your heart set on a certain shot, and it's looking like in order to get that shot, you won't get six others because it's so complicated or so specific as to time of day or whatever the problems are. To know that that shot is a good place to compromise and not do it and therefore get the other six, or that there's something about that shot that's so important, so significant to what you think the movie is and wouldn't be and would be significantly less without, then you got to do it. It sounds so stupid, but it's literally easy to forget when you're in the maelstrom of directing a movie, and that is this. If you don't shoot it, you don't have it. It's really strange, because it's what could be more elementary than that? But when it becomes, that simple truth becomes a huge issue. Oh, well, let's skip that. And you got to really think, really? Do you really mean let's skip it? Do you really mean you want to go into the cutting room and not have it? Because if you skip it, you won't have it. And those things can get kind of blurry and weird, and I certainly learned a lot about that, and that's a continuing issue. I feel much more comfortable in dealing with it now all these years later, but at that time it was a huge nail-biting, what do I do? What is the wise move here? And very tough to make those calls without some experience.
Welcome back to the projection booth. The Hitcher may not have been the first, but it's definitely one of the most effective road terror films. You guys probably know that I wrote about Killer Cars for Cashiers to Cinemark 16, so I'm not talking about those. I'm not talking about Christine and the car and some of the ones where you get a very supernatural feel from the car itself. I'm talking about flicks like Black Cadillac, Breakdown, Road Games, etc. So Robert Harmon contributed to another work of the genre with the 2004 film Highwayman with Jim Caviezel. And I actually thought it was going to be a Jim Caviezel, Barry Pepper vehicle, no pun intended, because they kept showing those two on the box cover, but no, it's pretty much Jim Caviezel. Barry Pepper's barely in the film. So gentlemen, what are some of your favorite road terror movies? I'll start with you, Brian.
Actually, I completely just ignored everything that you said in that entire paragraph, and I went with a segment from an anthology film. I'm talking about the Benediction segment of Nightmares. And yeah, so it's definitely supernatural, but in terms of compacting the experience of a road terror movie into just a badass 20 minutes, I don't think you get much better than that. And it really culminates in one of the greatest things I've seen a car do, and that's a whole He Who Walks Behind the Rose / Tremor scene with a truck going underground and exploding out in a – I don't even know. I don't have any words for how awesome it is. But yeah, that's mine.
Yeah, Brian, I really like that segment as well, and I always refer to that vehicle – which, if for anybody who hasn't seen it, it's essentially like the devil manifesting itself as this truck. And I like to call it Truckistopheles.
One of my other favorites Josh is going to talk about.
Yeah, you mentioned it actually already, Mike. I think Road Games, to me, is about as good as it gets. You have Stacy Keach in a rare leading man role, but not just a leading man role. A leading man role where he gets to talk to himself a lot. And that's one of the greatest pleasures I can imagine, is Stacy Keach just entertaining himself on camera. And the movie has this really loose feel where, even though it's really tightly structured and suspense really works, all the dialogue scenes, you know, feel very much like they could have been at least partially improvised. They feel kind of off the cuff and naturalistic. So you've got Stacy Keach interacting with Jamie Lee Curtis at arguably the pinnacle of her career, when she was doing a lot of the work that we love her for the most. And the suspense itself really works. And you've also got the crazy Australian stuntmen doing what they do best. Grant Page, of course, who's known for working with Brian Trenchard-Smith and George Miller and all the crazy Australian action directors. I'm sure Brian has a lot that he would like to say about Australian stunts.
In talking a little bit about some of the stunts that they shot for The Hitcher, John Seal took some cues from stuff he learned in Australian movies. And I imagine there's some similar shots in Death Cheaters, a Brian Trenchard-Smith film, and he also shot BMX Bandits. He talks about how he used a technique where they bury a camera in the desert and use a mirror to put where the cars or whatever is going to come over it, so that you can get these wild shots. And that's used when the two cars flip after the shotgun blasts in The Hitcher. But he got that cutting his teeth on Australian action films, which ties into Grant Page, which ties into Road Games. There you go.
Yeah, I don't know if we would consider it road terror, but talking about Australian road movies, I mean, they were kind of the masters of the road movie. And for me, it all kind of ends at the footsteps of Mad Max, and especially with The Road Warrior itself. Love all the car foo that happens in that film.
Yeah, the one stunt in that movie is arguably the most impressive stunt I've ever seen, where that character goes flying off of that car and spins, you know, head over feet three or four times in a row before, you know, flying off camera, is really one of the craziest stunts I've ever seen. I believe that gentleman broke his legs on that shot as well.
It's worth it, man. I mean, that shot is just killer. It is so good.
If that guy died and took other crew with him, it would still be worth it for that.
I wonder if things like The Hills Have Eyes, if we could kind of tie that one into this. I mean, we've got the desert and we've got the open road and everything, and we've got the terror part of it. Just not a whole lot of car stuff going on, really.
No, I mean, it definitely plays into some other things we were talking about with The Hitcher, though, where it's all about the terror of being alone out in the open, and you can hide, but you can also be very much exposed. So, I mean, it's a lot of thematic similarities, and it's equally frightening, I guess, but in a different way.
I think one of those frightening things about The Hitcher for me is the sequel and the remake. I don't know if you guys had the pleasure or displeasure of this, but I will tell you that the sequel to The Hitcher, which is called, I think, The Hitcher 2, I've Been Waiting, awful. Really bad. I mean, it's basically a redo of the first movie, except that at one point, so C. Thomas Howell, very traumatized, obviously. Jim Halsey's very traumatized by what happened with him and Ryder. He's not in any kind of psycho ward. No, instead he went ahead and he became a cop. And so he's patrolling the desert trying to take care of things, but he tends to use a little excessive force, which you might see at the end of The Hitcher. But yeah, he's out there and he's kind of, you know, protecting the world and everything. He gets fired from his job for using excessive force. So he and his, I don't know, wife, I guess, Kari Wuhr, they go on a little vacation and they're going to go visit Sheriff Esterhaz, or Esteridge, I should say, from the first movie. And so we're getting all like, you know, the familiar characters and stuff. And then they're out in the desert and there's a sandstorm and they happen to pick up a hitchhiker, which you would think that maybe Halsey would have explained to his wife, girlfriend, fiance, to Kari Wuhr, why he doesn't want to pick up hitchhikers. But we don't really get that. So instead they go ahead and they pick up Jake Busey. And I think one of the worst things you could ever do in life is to pick up Jake Busey and have him riding in the back of your car. So really not a good idea. And, you know, see Thomas Howell's having some fantasy scenes where Jake Busey is attacking him and all this kind of stuff. And then, of course, you know, it ends up that he is crazy, kills see Thomas Howell really early in the film. And then it becomes basically a remake of The Hitcher with Kari Wuhr instead of see Thomas Howell and Jake Busey instead of Rutger Hauer. And what's hilarious, though, and I recommend maybe checking this movie out because it's very funny. Every so often, the cops show up, and we had talked about the cops and that kind of black and white logic that they have. And the cops will show up, and Jake Busey will immediately do this kind of like Eddie Haskell personality and be like,
"Oh, Sheriff, look what she done to me. And I used that finger, too."
Bam! Kicking it up a notch.
See, I just called the sheriff myself a couple minutes ago. Yeah, problem with the counter man. Seems some crazy farm girl came in and messed him up real good.
They actually have Busey cutting off his own fingers and throwing them into a French fryer so that we can kind of have a nod to the fries from the first film. I mean, it is absolutely ridiculous. So yeah, it's got the French fry part, kind of like a little nod to that. At one point, Kari Wuhr ties him between a semi-truck and the other part of the semi-truck and all this kind of stuff. And he's basically egging her on through the whole thing, you know, kind of like Ryder was doing, but he's just being really super obnoxious about it. You know, just like, "I don't think you got it in you, girly girl." And just all this kind of shit that he's just spewing through the whole movie. Then let me tell you about the remake. You know, I guess what reminded me, we were talking, you know, a little Hills Have Eyes, and you know, Michael Bay has this whole thing where he likes to remake good movies from the 70s and 80s into these really horrible things. Let me just say, the beginning of The Hitcher remake starts with a CGI rabbit trying to cross the road and it gets splattered by a car. And the movie just goes downhill from there.
Is it a CGI car?
It might be, but it definitely looks a lot more real than the rabbit does. It starts off with the boyfriend, you know, the Halsey character, and he's already got the girlfriend there. So we've already got our Nash in the car. They're already together. And you would not believe the lengths they go through to get those two to not have cell phones anymore. It becomes this huge thing. You would think we're out in the desert, we don't have coverage. No, they have to like physically have them get rid of their cell phones. And it becomes this major ordeal in the script to get them away from their cell phones. And then we've got Sean Bean as the bad guy coming in. He decided that Hauer underplayed John Ryder, so he was going to underplay his version of John Ryder so much that he basically is comatose through the entire film. And he's just kind of walking through the whole thing. And usually I like him a lot, but he is just so underplayed in this movie and just so boring. And then the big twist in this one, and I'm not going to say spoiler alert because I don't think anybody should watch this film. The big twist is that they tie up Halsey between the truck and they splatter Halsey. And this time, of course, you get to see everything. There's no implied violence in this one. You get to see him pulled apart by the semi-truck. And then it becomes the girl's struggle from there. So, big twist on that one.
Well, that sounds awful. Now that you talk about both of them, I think I know I've definitely seen the sequel, and I promptly eliminated that from my mind. And the remake, I do remember the rabbit scene. I do remember seeing the pulling apart scene. I couldn't remember if it was from the sequel or the remake. You know, and while you were talking, I just discovered a very fun fact that Louis Morneau, who directed The Hitcher 2, also directed Joyride 2, a sequel to a movie that's not only inspired by The Hitcher, but rips it off in several places. Also rips off Road Games, tying that all together. So he's a master at doing tepid sequels to good films.
But in his defense, he did also make the motion picture Bats with Lou Diamond Phillips. So,
so Josh, I know you haven't seen Highwaymen, but Brian, what were your impressions of it?
I actually really liked it. I think Harmon is the best at ripping himself off. He does a lot of great stunts in Highwaymen that are just riffs on some of the great work he did in The Hitcher. So the basic story of Highwaymen is a man whose wife is killed by a terror car. A few years earlier, decides to go out on the road and track down this car. And I don't want to get too much into spoiler territory, but the driver of the terrorizing car is handicapped. And the way that they have put the bad guy into his car really kind of bridges the gap between the kind of movies you were talking about, which are more cars with drivers terrorizing people and supernatural cars terrorizing people. There's kind of a human car integration going on in Highwaymen. I wouldn't say that it's a particularly clever film. That aspect of it is full of a lot of really good ideas, and it's actually a really exciting, tight movie. I don't think it surpasses 85 minutes, and it's actually a really fun film.
Yeah, I rewatched that one the other day, and it really, yeah, it moves. It moves real fast, and it's like, it ends exactly where it needs to because it just moves really good. And yeah, you're right. I like the way that they don't show the driver for the longest times. So there is that kind of supernatural thing. And then when they do start to show him, you know, they ease up on him kind of thing. And they use a lot of, you know, back of his head kind of thing. So yeah, it's really kind of nice the way that they make it a lot more spooky than it even needs to. And for me, it almost kind of, you know, the way you were talking about the car driver interaction kind of reminded me a little bit of J.G. Ballard's Crash a little bit too.
Yeah, definitely.
You had made a good point too about the way that these films all kind of came out right around the same time too.
I don't remember the exact order, but it did seem that they all kind of landed on home video around the same time. I program a horror movie night, which I've been doing for about 10 years now. We watch a horror movie every Wednesday, and I feel like we watch these all in the span of a year or two. So the difference in quality between the movies that carried the Hitcher name and the one where the guy who injected much of the magic into the Hitcher was able to visit some of the same territory, that leap in quality was very noticeable with Highwaymen.
Getting back to Red for a little bit, one of the people that I was talking to about the Hitcher before the show, he was describing what he calls the Eric Red Road Trilogy, where he considers The Hitcher, Near Dark, and one called Cohen and Tate to be kind of a trilogy of road movies that Red wrote. And I finally tracked down Cohen and Tate, which, again, I think kind of like Highwaymen, not necessarily as promoted as it could have been. You know, I think the one of the bad things about Highwaymen was that it kind of just got released to DVD. You know, it didn't ever really have, as far as I know, and as far as what I think Harmon was alluding to in his interview, was that it never really had its day in the sun. Cohen and Tate, I don't even remember that movie. And when I see the title, I thought it was about a law firm, but it's about these two kind of badass killers out on the road. And really, I mean, the movie first 10 minutes aren't in a car. The rest of it all takes place in a car. Totally different subject matter than we had, you know, of course, with Near Dark and with The Hitcher. But it's also a really interesting film. If you guys haven't seen it, I'd totally recommend that.
Yeah, I think the problem with Cohen and Tate, it did come out in theaters, but kind of underperformed. And then it was released on VHS. And I don't think it found the audience it deserved for the reason that you're talking about. The title doesn't grab you. It's not clear what the movie is. The video box, you know, has faces on it. It's not really all of that obvious what it's going to be about. And then when it was time for, you know, people to revisit films like Near Dark and The Hitcher, which had developed a cult following, Conan Tate had never picked up that kind of cult following, and it's never made the jump. As far as I know, I think it's still trapped on VHS, and I think it's just never been marketed correctly for the people who would love it to know that it exists.
That is an interesting observation that it's kind of a rogue trilogy. I've seen all three films, and it absolutely makes sense. I think Red has some interesting obsessions and ideas about what can happen when the story is moving literally and figuratively in terms of narrative. When you have to keep things in motion, he has a knack for and seems to enjoy playing with what you can do in that situation.
All right, so we're going to take a break and play a preview from next week's show.
Every consumer has a small box in his head. Everyone has a soapbox, a bread box, a cereal box, a shampoo box. This box is the target of $46 billion a year in advertising. If we use creative foreplay before we penetrate, we'll
benefit.
How many syllables, Mario?
We'll never know. The corporate bylaws make it very clear that the only way we can determine a new chairman is by democratic process. Paragraph 68 specifically states that nobody can vote for himself.
Enough, caucus. Let's get the votes in.
How can we talk about who's going to be chairman of the board when my father's laying dead on the table?
One vote for Elias, one vote for Bissinger, 9 votes for Swope.
Swope! You don't have to accept. It's a terrible job. Don't take it, Swope!
The man's been elected and you voted for him.
We all voted for him. Because we thought no one else would vote for him. Putney Swope is the new chairman of this board. And I will defend that mistake with my life.
The changes I'm going to make will be minimal. I'm not going to rock the boat. Rocking the boat's a drag. What you do is sink the boat. And there's no sense sinking nothing unless you can salvage with productive alternatives. And brothers, you can't change nothing with rhetoric and slogans. Because if a man's really got the truth in his pocket, he doesn't talk about it. He hangs it out on a shingle where people can see it. So from now on, the name of this agency is Truth and Soul.
TS, baby.
That's right. Don't smoke it.
Be sure to tune in next week when Rob St. Mary will be back and we'll be talking to Robert Downey about Putney Swope. That's Robert Downey Sr., girls, so just calm your hormones down. So I want to thank this week's co-hosts, Brian Kelly and Josh Johnson. Brian, tell the folks at home where they can experience some of the Brian Kelly magic, as it were.
The best place is just to follow me on Twitter, BTS Junkie, that's J-U-N-K-I-E. And I do some writing for a local online daily in Austin called Culture Map. You can see some stuff there. But the more interesting work is going to end up back at Gordon and the Whale, which was a movie blog that went under last year but has been resurrected for a second life. And we're gearing up. And I do a weekly new to instant Netflix column there where I pick out my sort of tastes and tell people to watch them. It's for a very niche market, but I think most people who are listening to us talk about The Hitcher would enjoy the types of movies I have to recommend.
Josh, what's been going on with you? How's the progress on the documentary you're co-directing? Rewind this movie.
We're nearing completion at this point. In a few weeks, we're going to Cleveland for a weekend. Then the following weekend, we're in Toronto. Then we'll be in Japan for the last 2 weeks of May. And at that point, we'll be wrapped on production and focusing really intently on editing. We should start submitting to film festivals this fall.
Very cool. I can't believe you're going to such, you know, exotic locations like Cleveland. That's awesome.
I know. It was our dream, and we made it happen. It's a good feeling.
Where can folks go to check out the progress and maybe see some pictures of beautiful Cleveland?
They can go to rewindthismovie.com. And any and all updates will be showing up there. And if you want to keep up to date on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour basis, You can also follow our account on Twitter, which is @RewindThisMovie.
And be sure to check out my fellow bastards over at DailyGrindhouse.com, where we cover tough movies for a tough crowd. And be sure to stop by www.projection-booth.com for more of the Projection Booth, or listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or over at Jackalope Radio. And now let's sit back and enjoy some French fries. Please pass the ketchup.